What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Thursday, June 20th. And earlier this week, we had an NBA champion crowned for the 2023-24 season. And that is the Boston Celtics, who took down the Dallas Mavericks in five games, a rather uncompetitive five games. But with that said, we're going to talk all things Celtics, not only for this game, for this series, for this playoff run, but the whole season that they had, which was arguably a historical season in a lot of ways. Then I will talk about the Mavericks and where they fell short and where they go moving forward going into next season. So with that said, let's get right into it. So coming into game five, there was a lot of hype around the Mavs. It's funny how that works. It's just one game they win and suddenly everyone's back on the bandwagon. But Boston still had a very commanding 3-1 lead despite getting absolutely curb stomped in game four on the road, losing by 38 in that one. But Porzingis was back for this game and the Celtics were back at home. So they obviously felt confident coming into this one that they could close it out. But both teams started off this game a little bit jittery. You know, the Celtics were 1-5 to start, Mavs 0-3. Jrue Holiday got the Celtics going early with the first 6 points of the game. Couple layoffs, saw some cuts and slips off the screen, one on a fast break layup. And Boston was up 9-2 early. And it was a lot of what we saw in the first couple games. The Mavs looked a little out of sorts offensively. Nothing looked easy, not getting good looks. They were 1-9 from the field, 0-5 from three to start. They had only 2 points, two turnovers in the first 4:30 of game time. Luka hadn't scored yet. Dallas called timeout to get Josh Green and Derek Lively into the game. Then a little later, Porzingis checks in for the first time at the 6:49 mark. And that was good news for Dallas because Porzingis did not look like he was really ready to go in this one. They were putting him in every single action possible. They were putting him in screens, and he was not doing a good job of getting out to shooters or not really getting out to shooters at all. They were just running pick and pops every single time. They generated four consecutive wide open three-pointers as soon as he got in the game. Two of them they made. And on top of them going at Porzingis consistently, they got some good minutes from Lively and Josh Green as soon as they came in. Lively was active on both ends. Josh Green hit a couple three-pointers. But overall, it was a very defensive first quarter. Neither team shot particularly well. Celtics started 6 of 18. The Mavs started 6 of 17. Exum came in and gave the Mavs some good minutes as well. Hit a three again on a Porzingis pick and pop. But then out of nowhere, the Celtics had an avalanche to end the first quarter. They went on a 9-0 run in just barely over a minute. Jaylen Brown scored off a cut. Then Kleber missed a three. Then Sam Hauser hit a three. Then Luka turns it over. Brown gets a layup off a lob on that transition opportunity. Then PJ Washington turns it over immediately. Tatum scores in transition. And then the Celtics found themselves up 28-18 after the first quarter. So this was a lot of what we'd seen in the first couple games. And they stayed red hot. They started the second quarter 11-for-13 as a team. Tatum really started to get it going in this one after he had struggled for large portions of this series. The Mavs were able to push back a little bit, especially so Boston went small at the 6:30 mark of the second quarter. They took out all of their big men, were playing Tatum at the center spot. The Mavs immediately went on an 8-2 run. Gafford got a couple dunks. They had four field goals made all at the rim. But then they called timeout, got Horford back in, and they immediately went on a 19-7 run. They were attacking Luka defensively basically every time in the switches. Even Tatum finally made a step-back three-pointer, which he has struggled mightily with throughout this series. And then Peyton Pritchard, who was a DMP for basically the entire first half, comes in with 4 seconds remaining and hits a half-court buzzer beater, his second deep one of the series. And suddenly the Celtics are up 21 points at halftime, 67-46. And it was not looking good for Dallas at this point. They finally had gotten at least some contributions from the role guys, but Luka and Kyrie were just god-awful to start this game. I mean, in the first half, they had 14 points combined after both of them had that many points per person. in the first half of game four, let alone combined, but they were 6-for-18 combined, 1-for-7 from three, 1-for-4 at the free throw line. Luka had 3 turnovers, and we also had a really good Tatum game to start this one. He had 16, 9 assists, 4 rebounds on 6 of 11, and the Celtics' big run continued in the second half. They started hitting a barrage of 3-pointers. The Mavs were still really struggling. The lead got up to 26 points, and it looked like this one was basically a wrap, but the Celtics did finally start to miss quite a bit. They had an 0-of-8 from the field stretch. They finished the game 1 of their last 15 from 3-point range. The non-Tatum Celtics in the fourth quarter were 2-of-10 from the field. But the problem is the Mavs just could not take advantage. They could not take advantage. But both teams looked really tired down the second half stretch of this one. The Celtics only scored 39 points in the second half, but it didn't matter. The Mavs never got it closer than 17 points. They eventually built that lead back up to 26 because Tatum started pouring it on in the fourth quarter, 11 of Boston's 20 points in that quarter. And so the Celtics won this one running away. They actually, the Mavs had an 8-0 run to finish this game to make it an 18-point game, but it was never actually that close in the second half. Boston wins it 106-88. But this was really a very good representation of these teams and this series. And Boston going through some lulls here and there, but Mavs just never being able to take advantage, never being able to really get comfortable offensively. And for the Celtics, this was just a really good matchup for them. They matched up really well with Dallas for a number of reasons. I think one of the biggest gameplay moves that they made was to put Tatum on the Dallas big men. We had seen Lively and Gafford dominate through stretches of the postseason, make guys like Rudy Gobert look unplayable. They gave Oklahoma City and LA, teams without a lot of size, a ton of issues just scoring in the half court and being rim deterrents on the defensive end. And they were anything but advantages in this series. I mean, they got played off the court at times. They were neutralized a ton. Gafford, in the first 3 rounds, averaged 22 minutes per game. He played under 15 minutes per game in this one because Kidd just didn't feel comfortable with him out there. He played Kleber in much bigger stretches in this series in favor of Gafford just because of the mismatch that Boston had created. Lively, on the other end, he was very good in Game 3 and Game 4 when Kristaps Porzingis didn't play. But in the games Porzingis played, he averaged only 2 points per game, only 5 rebounds per game. He had 6 total points across the 3 games that Porzingis didn't play. So a total non-factor pretty much on both ends of the court. And the decision to have Tatum guard the bigs in this series gave them a ton of trouble in the pick and roll because most teams, when you put those guys in the pick and roll, the big either has to be late recovering, getting back, and that half little second when they're delayed allows for Luka to throw the lob up to the big man, or they've got a switch, in which case they're on Luka Doncic, which is probably the hardest cover for a big man in the entire league on the perimeter. But because they had Tatum there instead of the bigs, you're avoiding having big man put in space, having to guard Luka on the perimeter. Tatum is very capable there. I know that Dallas went at that matchup quite a bit in this series, but I think that was more to tire Tatum out rather than to like expose him for being a bad defender because he is a very good defender overall. The other part of it is that Tatum has the size to stay with the bigs, and he's got the foot speed to recover that other big men might not, and he's got the length to hang with those guys in the paint. But he's also a really good perimeter defender, as I said. So even if they switch, it just took Dallas out of their sorts in the pick and roll. It totally eliminated that part of the game. They had to do much more isolation because those pick and roll plays that were leading to lob dunk after alley-oop after lob dunk were just not there in the series. Boston did a really good job of guarding that. The other advantage Boston created here is they are a legitimate 5-out team. And so they were able to pull the Dallas big men out of the paint in a way that no other team was able to do in this postseason. It totally took away all of the Mavs' rim protection. Gafford and Lively combined to have 4 total blocks in this series. In the previous 3 rounds, they had averaged 3 between the two of them per game. So they were almost getting as many blocks per game as they had in this entire 5-game series. So it was definitely a factor in Boston being able to get downhill in this series. They didn't have to worry about the big man on the back end, because they were pulling those guys out of the paint because of just how much you have to respect the personnel on Boston and the way they want to play. They want to generate as many open looks from outside as they can, and so you have to be wary of that when you're defending them. They also matched up really well with Dallas because they are uniquely positioned to throw bodies at Kyrie and Luka. They can guard them straight up, which most teams cannot do. They took the role players out of it. They were not allowing Luka to be the same sort of playmaker that he typically is, what he was in the regular season and the rest of the other rounds. And they also had the personnel to really bother Kyrie as a scorer. Most teams are lucky to have one of Jaylen Brown, Drew Holiday, or Derek White to throw at Kyrie, but Boston had all three. And so it was a pick your poison on who you're trying to get switched on to him and who Kyrie's going to have to face on any given matchup. And Jaylen Brown also did as good of a job as we've seen anyone do on Luka. Like, Minnesota was the number one defense all season long, but Dallas was able to exploit that because of the vulnerability of Rudy Gobert as a big man having to guard on the perimeter. But Boston doesn't have those same sort of issues, and they've got so many different guys that they can throw at you that it's just makes it really difficult for you to attack mismatches, because they don't really have any mismatches. They switch on everything, and it's such a unique aspect to this team that I'm sure other teams will try to replicate. Just get a bunch of long freak athletes that can switch on every single play defensively, and that was really the key to making Dallas look really beatable offensively. It led to a lot of isolations from Kyrie and Luka, a lot of inefficient shots, and none of the role players were able to get going because of it. They totally took away the corner threes and the alley-oop lobs. Two aspects to Dallas's offense that have been vital to them getting to where they got this year. I also just think the Celtics just have too many guys that could beat them. Luka obviously got exposed a bit defensively in this series, and they weren't able to hide him on anybody because Boston doesn't have anybody you can kind of take plays off on that end of the court. They don't have a Kentavious Caldwell Pope or a Malik Beasley that you can just camp out on in the corner and not have to worry about them being involved in the action, because Boston involves everybody in their action. All five of their guys can go get a bucket for you. They can be the primary ball handler. They can be the screener. They can be a secondary cutter off a defensive breakdown. Like, all of them are capable of that, and all of them thrive at that. And so Luka had to be very involved on the defensive end at all times. And so it basically allowed this team to rinse and repeat. Have a guy blow by Luka, let the defense collapse, or someone step up out of their initial spot and then hit the open guy, whether that be for a corner three-pointer, a guy coming off a cut, or nobody steps up and they've got a easy drive to the basket. And they were just able to do that over and over and over again on the offensive end. And that was just, Dallas had no counterattack to that because Luka wasn't playing defensively to the level that they needed him to, and the rest of the guys weren't able to help recover and make up for that. And it's not to say Luka's the reason they lost, because obviously they need Luka out there for his offensive ability, but it was just a really tough matchup, like I said, and it also wore him out. It took a huge toll on Luka offensively, especially late in games. In the fourth quarter of this series, he averaged only 4.5 points per game. He shot 7 for 21, which is 33% in the fourth quarter of this series. He was 2 for 7 from 3, averaged nearly 2 turnovers per fourth quarter. And those numbers are skewed a lot by this last game where he actually played decently. But the first three games, and the fourth, he didn't even play in the fourth quarter. But in the first three games, he had only 8 total points across 3 fourth quarters. That's 2.7 points per game. He was 3 for 15 from the field in those games in the fourth quarter, 0-4 from 3. So he really struggled late in these games when they needed him most, and a lot of that is just because of the action they were consistently putting him in on the defensive end of the court. And a huge, huge credit to Joe Mazzulla for this, because all of these things are a product of his system, his schemes, and his game plan, and he put together a phenomenal game plan, in my opinion. And he's had his philosophy all year long about always switching on defense, shooting as many threes as you can, and it's worked out for them. But I just want to reflect on Mazzulla a little bit. This is a guy who was put in a really tough spot last year. He was only 34 years old, and its training camp had already started. Ime Udoka has his off-the-court scandal or issues or whatever you want to call it, and he gets thrust into being the head coach for a team with legitimate title aspirations. A guy who is 3 years younger than Al Horford has to now come into a very scrutinized sports city and lead a team to a championship. And he looked pretty in over his head at times last season, I thought. I thought he didn't have a good read on when to call timeouts. I thought he was maybe a little too rigid, sticking to certain philosophies sometimes. And he just looked a little lost. I think that that is fair to say. And they went to the conference finals last year, go down 3-0 to an 8-seed Miami Heat team, eventually force a game 7, but then get blown out in game 7 on their home court. And there were a lot of questions about if Mazzulla was the guy for the job. But I will say that he definitely won me over, not only on this finals run, but in this finals, because I thought every little X's and O thing that he put together was brilliantly executed. It obviously helps when you've got the personnel to be able to pull it off, but regardless, just like the putting Tatum on the big man thing, that's not something I would have thought to do. I thought Tatum should have guarded Luka coming into the series, but it was so effective. Just little things like that that he continued to impress me with. Not to mention, the guy now has a 121-43 record in the regular season, which is a 73.8% win percentage, which is the best in NBA history. So he currently has the best winning percentage of all time. In the playoffs, he's got a 69.2% win percentage, which is the third best in NBA history. So, of course, numbers can be deceiving. He got thrown into a very talented team, but it's hard to argue with those results. And he just won a championship now. And so, just credit to Mazzulla. I think he's matured a lot over the past year or so. I mean, he's now the youngest NBA head coach to win a title since Bill Russell, who was a player coach. So I don't even know if I want to count that in terms of full-time head coaches. He's basically the youngest to ever win one. And like I said, it helps when you've got the personnel. But I was just really impressed with Mazzulla. I thought he thoroughly out-coached Jason Kidd in this finals. He didn't even really need to make a ton of adjustments because their game plan was so sound and so brilliantly executed that it wasn't something we really needed to see them do. But I think he's gotten better with the calling timeouts thing as well. I think he's got a really good read on this locker room. I think they are fully bought in. And so I was a Mazzulla doubter, and I will say now that I think he is a very solid head coach. I think he brings a ton of value in terms of the scheme and the playing style that he has implemented with this roster, and the results don't lie. I mean, they were one game away from the finals last year after winning over 55 games. They won 64 games this year and absolutely cruised to an NBA championship. So credit to Joe Mazzulla and credit to the Boston organization and front office for sticking with him and seeing his vision and allowing him to put his players in prime position to thrive on this team. But obviously what makes Boston so great is their personnel. This is a stacked roster. And so just going down the line, Tatum in particularly was spectacular in game 5. He had 31-11-8. He was masterful getting downhill in the second half when really nobody else had it going for Boston. And I thought that that performance at least alone put him in the conversation for finals MVP, despite struggling through most of the series. But it's no secret that he didn't shoot super well. It's no secret that he didn't shoot or play as well as he could have offensively really throughout this entire postseason. In the postseason as a whole, he shot only 42.7% from the field. He was 28.3% from three-point range. In the NBA Finals, he was 38.8% from the field, 26.3% from three. And so, look, is this some otherworldly performance by Tatum? No. Did he carry them to this title? No. Is this going to elevate the general public's opinion on Tatum the way that we thought them winning a title would? Probably not. I don't think my opinion of where he stands in the league has changed drastically because of this, but I don't mean all that to say this as a knock necessarily, because we know how good he can be. as a scorer and a shooter. That's really his best asset. But the point is, he showed a lot of things in this postseason and took a lot of sacrifice because he, although he didn't shoot it well, he still led the team in points, rebounds, and assists. And he continued to contribute in so many other ways. I just want to keep in mind that Dallas's whole game plan was to stop Tatum. They didn't double Jaylen Brown. They didn't collapse extra hard or have a second guy cheat on Jaylen Brown. Those are all things they were only doing on Jason Tatum. Their game plan was to contain him. They doubled him many times. They, when he would drive to the basket, always sent a second guy, even when he's just holding the ball out on the perimeter. You can see the weak side defender cheating and helping a little bit towards him more than anybody else would for Boston. And so his evolution as a playmaker and a willing passer is a big reason for why this team was able to be so successful. He's constantly making the right plays as a playmaker. He averaged 7.2 assists in this series. He had an 11 assist game, a 12 assist game. And in the past, I think that he would have hunted his shot a little bit more. He still did that a little bit. We know he's addicted to the late shot clock, 2-for-1, step back three that he cannot resist. But the point is, I think that his buy-in and his willingness to be more of a playmaker was a big reason for why Boston was able to go on this run. In the past, Boston's offense has gotten really stagnant. And in this postseason, that didn't happen that much. And a big part of it is because Tatum is willing to get other guys involved a little bit more than he has in the past. And so there's two ways you can look at his struggled shooting. Obviously, we know that he's better than what he showed in this postseason from the field. But the other way to look at it is that they might have another level to get to. The crazy thing is he shot 29.8% on jump shots in this postseason. To put it into perspective, Giannis in the regular season shot 29.9%. So he basically was a Giannis-level jump shooter in this postseason. So I don't think he's going to continue to do that. So this just shows you that there's another level that he could reach and this team could reach if he shoots the ball a little bit better. And even with that, they were still dominant. And so I just think all the little things that he's bought into, he finally is putting the ego aside a little bit and deciding to be team first, which not that he's been a selfish guy, but just his maturity on both ends of the court. I mean, his willingness to guard the Dallas big men. There's a lot of guys who don't want to go out there and guard bigs unless they're big. We've seen guys talk about that in the past. Even a guy like Anthony Davis saying that he doesn't want to play center. But Tatum had no problem doing what the coaching staff asked him to do, whether that be guarding bigs, being more of a playmaker, sometimes taking over like he did late in game five. So I think overall, Tatum had a better series than his numbers would suggest. Still a little disappointing in terms of the shooting in this postseason, just because you can one bad series shooting, not a big deal, but it felt like the entire postseason he was in some sort of slump. It's hard to say that it's like because the moment's too big. I mean, he's had some pretty big postseason performances in the past, but regardless, he got the job done. He was good enough as a scorer and shooter, and he did all the other little things better than he has ever in the past. Then Jaylen Brown. I talked about him a little bit earlier in this series and just how much he's been the guy for this team offensively. And a lot of that has to do with the fact because Tatum is taking on the brunt of the defensive attention. However, Jaylen Brown has stepped up to take on the elevated offensive responsibility, and he's improved significantly as a decision maker, as a playmaker, as just a guy making the right reads on different plays, picking and choosing his spots. He's gotten better as a ball handler, and he's had some ugly postseason moments in the past. Game 7 last year, 8 turnovers, just careless turnovers. Tatum got hurt a little bit earlier in the game, and he wasn't able to step up when they needed him. And so he really has been a different player from what we've seen in the past from him. He's extremely decisive getting to the basket. He's strong getting to the rim. He is turned into a really elite shot maker and a really good defender. I mean, the fact that he was able to guard Luka as well as he did in this series and still be such a prominent offensive piece for this team, so impressive. He's hit clutch shots for them all postseason long. against Indiana in this series as well, in the games that were a little bit closer. And to me, he is the single biggest reason for why Boston was able to get over the hump this year. I know that adding Drew Holiday and Porzingis helped a lot. But they also lost a lot of guys from last year. Marcus Smart, Malcolm Brogdon, Robert Williams, Grant Williams. So they were going to need some internal improvement and able to get where they wanted to go. And Brown provided that. I think last year he was an inconsistent, flawed second option. This year, there's spark debate on who's the better player between Brown and Tatum. I still don't buy into that. I still think Tatum's the guy. I think he's the better, more consistent all-around player. But Brown has given him a run for his money on this team because he's just so improved. And I can't just emphasize enough how night and day it is for him last year versus this year in terms of the polishedness on offense as a scorer, as a playmaker, as a ball handler, as a decision maker. And so Jaylen Brown is obviously won both conference finals MVP and finals MVP. And so was just absolutely massive for this team. And they aren't even close to where they got to without him making the big improvements he made. But on that point, like I said, Drew Holiday, massive for this team. I thought he had a real case for MVP as well. I already talked about how much he had struggled with the Bucks in the postseason in the past. 40 playoff games with Milwaukee, shot sub 40%, only 30% from three, had very bad advanced numbers across the board, a negative net rating, a true shooting percentage below 48%. Virtually zero win shares. But with Boston just this season in the postseason, he shot well above 50% from the field, above 40% from three-point range, a plus 17 net rating, a 62% true shooting, which is absolutely night and day from when he did in Milwaukee. And his advanced stats were great across the board. And a lot of that has to do with just his role and his usage rate. He was a 23% usage rate with the Bucks in the postseason, only a 15% with Boston. And so I've said this, he can be a shot creator, he can be an offensive initiator, he can be one of your main scorers, but not consistently. That's not what he should be doing out there. His ideal role is what he is with Boston, which is him doing all the little things, being elite as an off-ball movement guy, making all the right cuts. He can run the pick and roll as the ball handler. He can also set the screen and slip to the basket, which we saw a ton in this game five, for example. He's always in the right spots at the right time, whether it be on the defensive end or as a shooter. He's always finishing the plays. He has a weird amount of strength for someone his size to be able to go in and has pretty good post moves as well. And so he is just the consummate winner, consummate role player, exactly what you want out of a third or fourth guy on your team. And he was spectacular for them in this postseason run. Just the such a huge high impact on this team and such a huge upgrade over a guy like Marcus Smart, who they had in the past, who had some of the same attributes as a hard-nosed defender and a guy who's not afraid to take big shots. But just the improved basketball IQ going from Smart to Holiday, just how much of a better shooter he is, a better decision maker, less sporadic, less turnover, like everything across the board. I mean, the guy didn't have a turnover until game four in the series. So he was just so damn good for this team. And he's complimented so well by Derek White as well. And Derek White has evolved his game so much since coming to Boston. He's always been a very good connective piece offensively, a good secondary playmaker and passer, and a versatile defender with length. But with San Antonio in the past, he was very inconsistent offensively. He was not a very good shooter, and he was a good defender, but not like a top-of-the-league type guy. But since coming to Boston, I mean, his first 5 years in the league, he shot only 34% from three. He has shot 39% from three over the last two seasons in Boston, and that was on a career-high volume this season. So he went from a below-average shooter to now a very good shooter on high volume. And it also just feels like he's always hitting the big shots for this team. Late in games, there's a collapse on Brown or Tatum. They kick it out. Feels like it always finds its way to Derek White's hands, and he always knocks it down. And he did that in this series as well. He's also probably the best shot-blocking guard in the entire league and one of the best shot-blocking guards ever. It's ridiculous. I mean, the one play earlier in the series where he blocked Lively on an alley-oop is just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, Lively's a legitimate 7 feet tall. This guy's maybe 6'4", and the timing, the anticipation, the concentration that this guy has is just off the charts. That on top of his really, really good perimeter defense, he's now made all defensive team 2 years in a row with Boston, and he continues to be that same connective piece that he was in San Antonio. He's not a true point guard, but he can run the offense a little bit, and he's going to keep the ball moving in the right spots consistently. And he has worked his way into being like a borderline top 50-ish player. This is a guy who, when Boston traded a first-round pick for him, people thought it was a little bit of an overpay. But he's more than made that deal worth it. I mean, people are pushing him for the All-Star game. I don't think he should have made it. But just saying that he was getting that type of buzz all season long just because of how good he had been. And then Porzingis, it's funny because of how dominant they were in the postseason even without him. It almost feels like he's just like a luxury for this team. But he's the guy who takes them from a really good team to a potentially all-time great team. He gives them a change of pace piece offensively in terms of just his post game and then his elbow face-up game, which we saw a lot of in this series because Dallas just didn't have big enough guys to put on him, especially off switches. But he stretches the floor up to a legitimate 30 feet or so because he's so tall, he can shoot over anybody. And he pushed Horford to the bench, which took away the need for them to play a traditional big for backup minutes. So they were always having a stretch five out there at all times if they needed to. Obviously, Cornette and guys like that got minutes during the regular season at times. But when it came to it, they were riding with the Horford and Porzingis at the center spot, little Tillman sprinkled in there, which for the system this team wants to play. As I said, they want to be switchable. They want to make shots. They want to play five out. Their previous teams didn't fit that quite as well because last year it was more of a pick your poison because they could either start Robert Williams and then they have a clear non-shooter out there at all times, but a good, very good rim protector in Williams, or they could play Horford, who is a legit floor spacer, but not really much of a rim presence in terms of rim deterrence and shot blocking. Porzingis gave them the best of both worlds. The elite shot blocking that Robert Williams brought with the very good outside shooting that Horford brings. And so he just opened a whole nother level to this team because they were able to still have the same rim protection they had with Williams, but didn't have to have him as a liability offensively because he can stretch the floor probably even better than Horford in terms of his range and consistency as a shooter. So Porzingis was not his best self in this series by any means. Like I said, in game five, he looked like a shell of himself. He could not really move, and I'm honestly shocked that they put him out there. But the point is, this guy just turned them from a really good to a great team, and he had such an impact for them all season long. And you could see the mentality shift for him, a guy that people in the past said that was kind of a losing player. Too big of an ego, didn't give a shit, didn't play hard all the time. And he did all of those things this year. He did give a shit. He played super hard on both ends. He wanted to get out there with his teammates so badly in the finals, despite the risk of him like suffering a pretty serious injury. It sounds like there was chance for. So a luxury for this team, but a guy that they needed to get into the position that they were in to be as dominant as they were in the postseason. And then just closing out with two other guys, their top two bench guys, Al Horford, really happy for him to be able to get this title. He's 38 years old, but he is still a modern day big that anybody would want on their team. He's still very solid defensively, especially guarding opposing big men. Not so great at guarding in space, at least not as good as he used to be there, but still not a liability on the defensive end. I don't think anyone would argue. He also has turned himself into one of the best shooting big men in the entire league. I mean, the first 7-8 years of this guy's career, he didn't even shoot from the outside. But he's adjusted to the modern NBA, tweaked his game, evolved himself into a better version of what he can be offensively in today's league. He shot 43.4% from three over the last two seasons combined. That's an insanely impressive number. He also now holds the NBA record for best three-point percentage in an NBA Finals career at 56%, which obviously small sample, but absurd number right there. But he's totally egoless player at this point, willing to do whatever it takes. They said that he went to Joe Mazzulla when they got Porzingis and told him to bring him off the bench because he thought it'd be better for the team. Didn't care if he started or if he was coming off the bench. Didn't matter if he was playing the four, the five, whoever he was guarding. The guy was just willing to do whatever it took to win. And it's really nice to see that he finally got his ring after so many years of success. Only 6-7 games away from becoming the all-time leader in games played without winning a title in the postseason. But and then just lastly, Sam Hauser was really big for them in this postseason. 11 for 23 from three in the finals, 48%. He had big shots in game three when nobody else had it going outside of Tatum, and they could have easily let that game slip away. He had three threes in that first half. He held up better defensively than I ever could have anticipated. A guy that you'd think that the Mavs would be able to attack absolutely held his own when guarding players like Luka and even Kyrie at times. And he was just a true rotation guy on both ends of the court in a way that I'm not sure I ever thought he would be, at least in a postseason setting. And so just credit to him for working on his game on both ends, and credit to Boston's front office for turning a two-way player into a legit seventh man on an all-time great NBA Finals champion. Switching gears a little bit, I know there was a lot of discussion about the Finals MVP. I don't have a huge, huge hard opinion on this. I think it honestly could have went to any of Tatum, Brown, or even Drew Holiday, and it would have been fair or justifiable. Tatum led the team in counting stats, points, rebounds, and assists, but he was very inefficient. He did guard the bigs, which made a big difference for them in terms of what they were trying to do schematically. Jaylen Brown guarded Luka, which was obviously a tall task, and then he had the best games during the closest games. So game two, game three, he really got them over the hump in those two games, and those were kind of the swing games, if you want to say they were swing games. Game one, four, and five were never close. And so you could argue the series was won in game two and three. Jaylen Brown had the best games during those games. So if you want to put more weight in those games, I totally understand giving it to Jaylen Brown. I think that's a very logical line of thinking. I honestly wouldn't have been mad if Drew Holiday won it either, because I know he was more of a role guy for this team, but that was his role on the team. And he had the lowest counting stats, but he was by far the most efficient between Tatum and Brown. And he guarded Kyrie and did a phenomenal job shutting him down in this series. And so I thought he was maybe the most consistent, not most consistently great offensively in terms of volume. But I just mean if he didn't have any bad games, for example, maybe game four, but kind of everybody had a bad game four for Boston. So I thought after game one, it was Jaylen Brown. After game two, it was Drew Holiday. I never really thought Tatum was in the lead for this. He kind of started to sneak up after game three, and then game five, he was clearly the best player for Boston in that game. So I personally don't really have much opinion. If any of the three had won it, I wouldn't have made a big deal out of it. I probably would have went with Jaylen Brown just because Drew Holiday's counting stats were just a little lower than I'd like. And if you want to argue, Drew had a big defensive impact, well, so did Jaylen Brown and so did Tatum, honestly. And I know Tatum led him in all the big counting stats, but I just kind of feel like if you're a first-team All-NBA player and you shoot 39% from the field, you kind of disqualify yourself. Unless it was a 2015 LeBron James scenario where there's literally nobody else on the team and he's averaging 35-point triple-double or something like that. But for Tatum to only average in the low 20s and shoot 39%, it's kind of a tough sell, in my opinion. I don't think game five was enough for him to win it off that one game. And to be honest, I don't think he was the best player for Boston in any of the other four games. So I don't know. I thought Brown winning it was fair, but ultimately, anyone who's making a big deal out of who won it or who deserved to win it, it didn't really matter. This was a team championship. They could give the Finals MVP to Mazzulla or Brad Stevens or all three of these guys. I think they would have done it because it really was not one guy who took this team over the top. I will say, though, in terms of the discourse around Finals MVP and, like, specifically Jason Tatum, I don't know if this, like, without him winning MVP and him now having two finals appearances where he shot below 40% in both of them, I don't think this run really helped him in his standing in the league as much as you would have thought. Like, legacy-wise, it obviously helps him a ton. When we look back at his career later, we'll say that he won a championship, was the presumed best player on a title team, et cetera, et cetera. But I just mean, like, Jokic last year, there was debate over whether he was the best player in the league or not. And then when he won the championship, it was like, okay, no-brainer, he's the best player in the league. And we've seen stuff like that in the past. Giannis, when he won, people vaulted him up to number one kind of indisputably, and et cetera. But I don't think Tatum, like, it's not like Tatum moves up from the eighth best player to the second best player or anything like that. I still think he's in the 5 to 6 range. I kind of already had him in that general range before. I think that's probably where I still have him, because I just don't think he did anything so spectacular in this postseason that would vault him into that conversation. Like, I'm sorry, Luka's still a better player. I still think that Giannis is a better player. Jokic is a better player. Like, you can argue that SGA is less accomplished, but if you put SGA on this team in place of Tatum, you're telling me you don't think that they could have still won? You could debate guys like Embiid as well, just off the availability thing, but I think everyone would agree that when healthy, if all things considered, Embiid is still probably the better player. But obviously, if you want to value durability, that's a fair opinion to have as well. So my point is he's in that 5 to 6 range still, if I would say. I don't think you can even get him close to that top three combo between Jokic, Luka, and Giannis, and that's okay. That's okay. Those guys are really good, and this was a team championship. That's not anything to take away from the Celtics, not anything to take away from Tatum. He was an integral part. He's still the best player on this team, in my opinion, and so, like I said, it helps his legacy. I just don't think that it's one of those championships where we push him up 5 spots in his ranking in the league because of it. And I also think that if they had given him the Finals MVP rather than Brown, but they still had the same performances, I don't think it would have mattered either. I don't think it is like this, like, because he didn't win it. If he had won Finals MVP and averaged 35 points per game, then maybe we're having a different discussion. But obviously that didn't happen. So again, this is not a knock on him. It's just to say that, like, he didn't win this championship for them. He was a contributor to the larger effort that the entire team had to win this championship, which, again, not a knock, just calling it out that it's a little different from when Jokic won it last year, where we know that you replace Jokic with anybody and Denver still might not win that championship. So, but for the Celtics as a whole, this was legitimately a historic season. I mean, they went 80-21 overall. They were 64-18 in the regular season, 16-3 in the playoffs. In the regular season, they were 14 games better than the number 2 seed, which is the biggest gap since 1976. That is before the NBA-ABA merger. They clinched a playoff spot 17 days before any other team did. They had the 4th best net rating in NBA history. They had the 5th best margin of victory in NBA history. They had the best offensive rating in NBA history, as well as a top 3 defense this season. They made the 2nd most 3-pointers in NBA history with over 1,300. They won or tied the season series with 18 of the other 29 teams. The only team that they didn't was Denver, who they lost both games to. They never lost more than 2 games straight all year long and only did that 4 times. They had more games where they led by 30 or more points than they did when they were down by 10 points. They had the most 25-point wins ever with 17 of them. They had the most 30-point wins ever with 10 of them, and they had the most 50-point wins ever with 3 of them this season. They only had 1 20-point loss all season long to go along with 19 times that they did that to other teams. They had 10 wire-to-wire wins where they didn't relinquish the lead a single time, and they only had 1 single wire-to-wire loss. All of that in the regular season. Then talk about the playoffs. They were the 2nd team ever to lose three games or less in the 16-win playoff era. Only the 27 Warriors did that as well when they lost only one time. And then if we extend that to the area where it took only 15 wins to win the championship, that they are the sixth team ever to only lose three or less, to go along with the 17 Warriors, the 89 Pistons, 91 Bulls, 99 Spurs, and the 2001 Lakers. They had the sixth best playoff margin of victory in NBA history, and that included a 38-point loss in Game 4 of this final. So imagine if they had just lost that game by 5 or 10 points, they could have been much higher up that list as well. They are one of only eight teams ever to outscore teams by 10-plus on average in both the regular season and the postseason. They had the seventh longest playoff win streak ever at 10 games, and they didn't trail in a series one single time. So there's a lot of numbers that suggest that this is a historically dominant team, and I think that the reason people don't really want to talk about that that way is because they don't have the guy. They don't have that top 20 all-time player that people like to point to when they talk about teams like this. Like the 01 Lakers with Shaq and Kobe, the 17 Warriors with KD and Steph, the 96 Bulls with Michael Jordan. Like, those teams had that extra little star power, and a name like Jason Tatum's not quite as sexy as that. But if we're looking strictly at just how dominant the teams were, they are in that conversation. And I think I mentioned this on a previous pod. They remind me a lot of the 2014 Spurs. Same sort of thing. They still had Tim Duncan, Kawhi Leonard, Tony Parker, but Kawhi wasn't nearly what he was today. He was not an all-star, all-NBA level player. Tim Duncan was past his prime as well, as was Tony Parker. And so that was more of a total team type championship similar to this one. That team doesn't get talked about in the same way that some of these other teams were, but I think that's a good comp for how dominant this team was. That team also kind of cruised through the regular season, cruised through the postseason. They won 60-plus games. They dominated the finals against a prime LeBron James and a Miami Heat team that was still very good at the time. But so regardless of where you want to put this team all time, the numbers suggest they are a historically dominant team, and they were a really well-built team. They constructed a team that was elite offensively in terms of balance. They had five guys that can score in the isolation, five guys that can shoot from outside at a high clip, five guys that could give you 30 on literally any given night, five guys that can handle the ball, and all of their five guys, zero defensive liabilities, all of them are plus defenders, all of them can guard multiple positions, all of them can switch almost entirely interchangeably. They've got two of the top-end league perimeter defenders in Holiday and White. You've got Tatum and Brown, who are two of the best wing defenders we have in the league that can guard up, they can guard down. Then Porzingis, who, as I mentioned, one of the absolute best rim protectors and shot blockers that we have in the league. And they've got just everybody bought in on both ends. You got a guy like Jrue Holiday could score 6 points one night and they win by 25. The next game, they might need him to score 22, and he's very able to do so. We've got nights that we saw in this finals where Tatum scores 30-plus. There's other nights where he's got 12 assists, and he's deferring way more to his teammates. So just so well-constructed. They switch everything. They shoot a million threes. Everybody's capable. They had the perfect personnel to go with their scheme and their system, and they were truly dominant start to finish on this season. They were the favorites in the preseason. They were the favorites to win it throughout the entire regular season, and they ended up winning the whole thing. And I think one of the reasons why people aren't so bought in on this team as being so fun and they won't maybe look back on the same way is because it was kind of boring. But it was so boring because they were so good. They didn't have any back against the wall moments in the postseason. They didn't have any like all-time great games other than maybe you could argue a couple against Indiana. But even if they had lost one of those games to Indiana, it would have been inconsequential, which is why it doesn't have the same stake, because you knew they were just going to bounce back and win that series, especially without Haliburton. And so I think this postseason had a lot of blowouts. I think Boston particularly played a lot of lopsided games. But again, it's just because they were so good. They were so good that it didn't feel like that enjoyable to watch. It didn't feel like you got the same sort of nostalgia attached to this team because they just kind of never faced any adversity. And you can say, well, Porzingis got hurt. Well, sure, he did, but so did everybody else they played. And again, I'm not saying that to knock them. I already been on record. I don't really care how, like, what their path was and how easy it was. Everybody has to catch some breaks if you go on to win the title. But the point is just they never really had that adversity. And so I think it'll be really interesting and fun watching this team continue to play into next year to see if they do have more of a challenger next year. Maybe the East is a little tougher, but that begs the question of, which we got to talk about every year because people want to talk about it, of it, could this turn into a dynasty? And I'm not saying definitely no, but I would say highly unlikely for a number of reasons. One, we said that exact same thing about Denver last year. They cruised to a championship. They brought everybody back. Everybody fell in love with all their players, all their moves. They sent the front office, even though they weren't being aggressive. People thought that they were smart and being strategic. And they ran into a team this year that was fully prepared to take them down. And the West was a lot stronger. They didn't have the same easy path that they had the year before. And so it's easy to sit here every year after the recency bias of seeing a team dominate in the postseason and think, oh, well, why wouldn't they? Well, we've now had six straight years with six different champions. I'm sure we thought the Bucks would have gotten back to another finals by now, but they haven't. I'm sure after LeBron and AD won in LA, we would have think they'd get a little closer than they have. Well, they haven't. They were the favorites going into the playoffs next year. Still didn't happen. Denver, as I said, didn't even make it to the conference finals again this year. The Warriors didn't even make the playoffs this season. So it's really difficult to do this year over year. And not even to mention that Boston, I mean, I don't say this to take away from them. I have been on record saying that this isn't important in terms of what we'll look back on historically, but they did kind of have it laid out on a silver platter for them this year. I mean, to make the finals, they avoided Jimmy Butler. They avoided Joel Embiid. They avoided Giannis Antetokounmpo. They avoided Jalen Brunson. They avoided Damian Lillard. They only got partial Donovan Mitchell. They only got partial Tyrese Halliburton. I mean, those are probably the best seven non-Celtics in the Eastern Conference. And five of them, they didn't have to play a single game against, and two of them got hurt in the middle of the series. So I don't think that they will get away with two straight years of getting to avoid the seven best players in their conference that are not on their team. I'd be shocked if that happened. That's not even to mention that all year we talked about how Denver kind of had their number. They beat them twice in the regular season. People thought it was theoretically their toughest matchup. They avoided them. Minnesota took them out for them, and then people thought, oh, Minnesota would have a good chance against Boston, and then Dallas took them out. So it was a kind of a rock, paper, scissors situation in the West this year. They didn't have to play a team like OKC either. And so this was their year. This was their year. They had the number one seed. There was a ton of injuries. They avoided the theoretical top couple teams in the West as well. And they even had an injury themselves, but were able to overcome it just because of the competition that they went up against. And so they're going to bring everybody back next year. I think they've got their top seven guys under contract for next year, if not top eight. So they'll be very good. There's no reason to think that they won't compete for a top one or two seed again next year and be in prime position to make the finals again. But Giannis can be back. And the Bucks are going to have a full off season with Doc Rivers. There was rumors that Damian Lillard was out of shape coming into last season because he didn't want to get hurt before the trade rumor talks. And so they'll probably try to revamp some of their issues. And so I think Milwaukee will be back, and I think they'll be a force to be reckoned with in the East. The 76ers have three players under contract right now. Embiid, they'll re-sign Maxey to a max extension, and then they've got all the flexibility in the world to basically start from scratch with the roster, whether that be adding a Paul George, whether that be trying to trade for a Jimmy Butler, whether that be just adding a bunch of really high-level role players. They've been linked to Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I know they want to bring back the role players they have, and Kelly Oubre and Nick Batum and other things. So they've got a lot of flexibility. They can also trade for someone that they just take into their cap space. So they're going to be back. Assuming Embiid is healthy going into the year, they should again be a top two or three seed, which is where they were most of last year before the Embiid injury kind of derailed their season. The Knicks, they will be, there's no way they're going to be as injured as they were this year, but they've also got ammo to add a star. They've got a ton of picks to move. They've got movable contracts, and this is the year for them to do it. This is the offseason to do it because they're going to soon be in the second apron, having to pay OG Anunoby, having to extend Brunson, all the other guys on the team. And so they might put all their chips in to make a big move this summer as well, so they could be a force to be reckoned with, at least a team that could compete with Boston. The Pacers showed that, I know they didn't win a game against the Celtics, but they can hang around with them. They at least were, they were probably the most competitive team with Boston despite getting swept. And who knows if Halliburton doesn't get hurt? Who knows if they just inbound the ball correctly in game one, win that game? Halliburton maybe doesn't get hurt. And then who knows? Maybe that thing goes six games. I'm just saying they should get better. They've also got some assets to improve if they want to. They just re-signed Siakam, so he's not going anywhere. And Horford is 38. He will be 39 by the end of next season. Kristaps Porzingis will never not be an injury risk. Just, we saw this season, finally made it through a regular season pretty healthy, but then got hurt at the worst time possible. So for him to make it through back-to-back finals runs is a pipe dream, to say the least. Jrue Holiday is also 34 years old, so while he's still very effective and can kind of take a back seat into a lesser role, he's still getting up there in age. And so what I will say is that it's not going to be as easy next year. Because it was kind of easy for them this year. It's crazy to say championships are never easy, but it felt pretty easy. They really didn't face much adversity. They just didn't have to go up against the big juggernaut that every team eventually has to face most of the time. And so I think that it's going to be very difficult for them to build this into a legit dynasty. Could they get back to the finals? Sure. Could they win it next year again? They totally could. But I don't consider back-to-back titles to be a dynasty. I think you got to win at least three in a five-ish year span or something like that, which they could do. I just think that with the new restrictions with the second apron, which the Celtics are a second apron team, so it's going to become increasingly more difficult for them to make moves very, very soon. And I think that the East is not going to be as injured as it was this year. And I also just think the league's really good. We're in an era of parity, and I think that that's going to continue for at least a little bit longer. Though, they should be the favorites next year. They will be the favorites next year. And I wouldn't fault anybody for thinking that they should go on to repeat next season. Moving to the Dallas side of things. They lost this series for a number of reasons. The easiest one is just that the Celtics are a better team. They're a better team. A lot of people thought Luka was the best player. The Celtics were the best team. But they were so clearly the better team. The personnel's across the board for both team was not comparable. Boston just had more weapons, more good players, and more ways to beat you than Dallas did. And Boston did a really good job of taking away a lot of the things that Dallas uses to win games typically. And it's funny because a lot of the talk about this series was Dallas's defense. I talked about it as well a bit with Luka and his struggles on that end. But they didn't lose this series because defense. They played quite well defensively in this series if you look at the stats. I mean, Boston on the season had an offensive rating above 123. They had a 120 offensive rating in the first round, almost a 122 offensive rating in the second round, and then almost a 123 offensive in the Eastern Conference Finals as well. But in this series, Boston had a 112 offensive rating. So they were pretty significantly worse in this series. I mean, a full 10-point drop-off in terms of their offensive rating in this series compared to the entire rest of the season and every other playoff round as well. They never scored more than 107 points in this series. Like, if you had told me going into the series that Boston was never even going to reach 108 points, I would have thought the Mavs had a really good chance. But clearly that wasn't the case because Dallas had significant offensive issues. They only had 109.4 offensive rating in this series, and that's including the big game four where they scored 122. But the rest of the games, 89 points, 98 points, 99 points, 88 points. Like, you're not going to win a series scoring under 100 four out of five games. And their offense was much better during other parts of the season. They had a 118 offensive rating during the regular season, 119 in round one, struggled a little bit in round two against the Thunder, 113, still a good amount better than they had in this series, and then 121 offensive rating against the Wolves in the conference finals. So they were largely very good offensively, except for a little bit of some struggles in round two, but they were even worse in this series than they were in round two against the Thunder. But I talked about this, that the Thunder were kind of like a small, light version of Boston in terms of just their playing style. They're willing to switch on players. They're got five guys that can defend, five guys that can shoot, except for Josh Giddey, which is, I mean, part of the reason why they lost and couldn't beat them. But the point is, they just didn't play to the level they need to offensively, and credit Boston, because that was by design. They got them out of a lot of the things they wanted to do. They took away the corner threes, like I mentioned. They took away the alley-oop lobs, like I mentioned. They made Luka and Kyrie play a lot of isolation, which they can do, but they just didn't do well in this series. I thought Luka was probably a little injured. He was certainly compromised to a certain extent in this series, not to make excuses for him, but they needed, if he was going to win this series, they needed like a all-time great elite Luka series, like a average 36 points a game on efficient shooting, nobody can stop this guy type series. Even then, they might have still lost. They maybe still would have lost, but they needed that out of him. And they got like a B minus, C plus series out of Luka at best, probably. And he just couldn't generate looks for other guys the way he's done in the past. He really struggled shooting from outside. He was 11 for 45 from three in the series, which is 24%. He had a stretch where he was 1 for 21 from three. So just really couldn't generate outside shots for himself. Wasn't generating outside shots for other people. So it was a lot of him just shooting two-point shots, which is exactly what Boston wanted. He was also weirdly terrible from the line, 17 for 29 from the free throw line. That's 59%. He was also really bad in the fourth quarter. I shared those stats earlier, but he was really, really bad in the fourth. And a lot of that had to do with just the wear and tear, them putting him in so many actions on the defensive end for him. And it could have had to do with him being a little banged up as well. But he just had to work too much to get his shots. And he wasn't the same version of himself that we saw versus Minnesota, that we saw throughout the whole regular season. Like, he struggled in this series, and he still puts up his numbers because that's what he does. Like, no one's going to sit here and majorly complain about 29 points a game, 9 rebounds, and 6 assists, which is what he averaged. And even his 47% from the field, it's not bad. But it was just, you could tell, he was not the best version of what we've seen out of him, and they were going to need the best version out of him if they wanted to win this series, especially when you consider how poorly Kyrie played. He just didn't show up in the series. He really didn't. And especially the games in Boston, he was just a absolute shell of himself. He had 12 points in game one on 6 for 19 shooting, 16 points in game two on 7 for 18 shooting, and then 15 points in game five on 5 for 16 shooting. So that's 14 points per game on 34% overall in the games in Boston. And so there's no way that they could expect to win. Before the series started, I called out 6 things that I thought would decide the series. And one of them was Kyrie needing to outplay Jaylen Brown. Well, Jaylen Brown won Finals MVP, and Kyrie didn't even hit 20 points one time on the road in this series. So that was a huge factor, clearly. And because he wasn't even remotely close to as good as Brown, or really Tatum or Jrue Holiday or anybody in the starting lineup for Boston, if we're being honest, then they weren't going to have a chance, and they didn't have a chance. And so he's still a really, really good player, but it's just he's not as consistently dominant as a playoff performer as he might have been back when he was with Cleveland. And so the outside of their top guys not playing well, which obviously it's going to be really difficult for them to win if Luka and Kyrie don't play well, it was equally as much of a reason why they weren't competitive in the series because of the major deficiencies of their role players. And a lot of what we saw out of the role players isn't surprising because it's largely been what they've been most of their career, but it was such a contrast to what we'd seen during the rest of the postseason. PJ Washington was essentially acting as their third option. He was 27% from three in the series, only 6 for 22, but he's just not a third option. He's not a third option. Look at any of the other teams that are trying to contend, and it's not even close in terms of third options. I mean, the Thunder have either Chet or Jalen Williams, depending on how you want to look at that. Both far superior players to PJ Washington. The Celtics got either Jrue Holiday, Derek White, Porzingis, whoever you want to say. The Bucks have Chris Middleton. The Nuggets have Michael Porter Jr. or even Aaron Gordon, who's a little bit better on that end of the court. Like, down the line, it's just the all the contending teams have a better third option than a guy like PJ Washington, and maybe the only team that you could say doesn't is Minnesota, and that was kind of their downfall too. It was the same thing. They just didn't have reliable scoring options after Anthony Edwards, and then Carl Anthony Towns didn't play up to the number two status that he needed to. And so it was pretty similar for why they lost. But they clearly are going to need an upgrade in that spot if they want to eventually get over the hump here. Derek Jones Jr., also, his shot basically fell off a cliff in this series. He was only 3-for-12 from three, made the very first shot attempt for Dallas in the series, so 2-for-11 from three from that point on. 25%. In the series, and I've talked about his progress as a shooter and how he was really not a good one for most of his career, but he had been spectacular so far in this postseason from outside, at least comparatively to what he had been, but he went right back to what he was as a shooter earlier in his career. And then just going down the rest of the team, I mean, Gafford and Lively were spectacular for this team throughout most of the playoffs and in their stints in the regular season as well, but they're not shot creators. They just aren't. They have to be fed the ball in their spots, or otherwise they provide almost nothing offensively. And so as they look to find other creators and other options down the roster, there just wasn't many there. And even like aside from that, I mean, a guy like Maxi Kleber was just awful in this series. He was 17% from three, only 1-for-6. He's since coming back from his injury, honestly, he's been unplayable. I mean, 5-for-18 from the field, 28%, 2-for-10 from three. In the seven games, he has 14 total points, so only two per game, only 9 rebounds in 7 games, 4 assists, and 12 fouls. So almost as many fouls as points. So they just don't have the reliable third shot creator or a semblance of a reliable third option. They were a very by committee after their top two guys team, and that just isn't enough against Boston. You got to have weapons and guys that can make plays against a team like Boston, and they just didn't have that. You can get away with it against Minnesota because they suffer from a lot of the same issues. After Anthony Edwards and Towns, it's a lot of the same. Gobert can't do much for you offensively. Mike Conley can do some here and there, but not consistently at this age. Jaden McDaniels, an inconsistent player. But even those guys can shoot at least, whereas the Dallas guys, just their shooting fell apart. They had no consistency in this series. And I also thought, aside from that, I thought Jason Kidd got a little bit outcoached. I don't know why he wouldn't play Dante Exum more. I called this out as a potential adjustment for him, getting more ball handlers out there, taking the pressure off of Luka and Kyrie a little bit. He also is really the only player that knocked shots down. He was 7-for-10 from the field in this series. Meanwhile, the rest of their role players couldn't hit the side of the backboard if they were trying most of the time. I also thought they should have tried to move more towards Josh Green and Lively in the starting lineup. He stuck with the same lineup that had gotten them there. Did move away from some Gafford minutes, but again, just an obsession with the same starting lineup. They clearly played better when Josh Green and Lively were out there. I thought game three, he played Tim Hardaway Jr. to death in that game. He was so unplayable. He couldn't make a shot. He was terrible defensively, getting attacked every time in a game that they had a chance to win and potentially make this somewhat of a competitive series. But he was so married to the idea of putting Hardaway in there that it just ultimately wasn't enough. And then I also thought that they could have played Jason Tatum a little bit differently. I thought they put too much attention on him. He wasn't making shots, and they never really forced him to make shots. They were too concerned with him, and as a result, other guys just were able to eat for Boston. So just, you know, they didn't have the personnel to compete with Boston. So it's not like there's really too many people to blame for this. It's more of a just like they've got to consider making some roster moves if they want to get to the point where they could compete with a team like Boston. So with that said, this was still a wildly successful season for Dallas and really everybody involved. I mean, despite the struggles, like, it was a major stock up season for Luka. He led the postseason in total points, rebounds, assists, steals, three-pointers made, two-pointers made, overall field goals made, and triple-doubles. And he carried a team to the finals that had one other reliable scorer. And he didn't look particularly healthy through most of the postseason. Who knows, if he had been totally healthy, if things might have gone slightly different. Probably not totally different, but maybe a little bit more competitive at least. But at age 25, this is a huge stepping stone for Luka. There's really no way to look at this season as anything but a grand success when you are a 25-year-old star with a good but flawed roster and you make it all the way to the finals and lose to an absolute juggernaut. We saw LeBron do that early in his career, and so I'm just not in the business of shitting on guys for losing in the finals. I think that they had no business even getting there. They weren't a top four seed in the conference. They beat some really good teams to get there. I mean, the Clippers, I know Kawhi was hurt, but they were one of the favorites in the West through most of the season. OKC won 57 games and were the number one seed. They knocked them off pretty comfortably. And then they absolutely steamrolled Minnesota, who looked like the favorite going into that series once they had knocked off Denver, the other presumed favorite going into the postseason. So it was a really impressive run by them, even though they fell up short. And Luka is obviously the sole reason they were there. The only reason. I don't think there's another player you could put on this roster outside of maybe Jokic that would have gotten them this far given what they had to go up against. And so just credit to Luka for showing what he can do, finally getting over the hump to an extent. And so it's a good stepping stone for him moving forward as he does look to eventually try to win a championship. On Kyrie's side of things, I don't think that this season showed us anything we didn't know about his on-the-court stuff, but I do think it revitalized his reputation as a teammate and as a winning player. He was very bought into this group. He was very content as the second fiddle. He played hard. He said mostly all the right things. He wasn't a distraction. And so in terms of on-the-court stuff, we know how good he is. We know what he can do. So I'm not going to say he like proved anything on that front, but I do think he proved a lot to this team and to the league and to fans and the media with his off-the-court behavior and just general attitude coming into the season. And he showed that he is still very capable of being a very solid number two option. Though obviously he did struggle in the finals, he still is just a huge reason for why they got this far. He was spectacular against Minnesota. He didn't shoot particularly well against OKC, but he still played well in that series. It was an impactful low-scoring series for them on the defensive end and as a playmaker. And so he showed that he can buy into a team again, and it was a very successful season for him and a needed season for him given just where his reputation had gone for his off-the-court antics. Then, I mean, go down the list. Derrick Jones Jr. had an absolute career year. He's going to be a free agent. He's going to get paid handsomely this offseason, you would think, considering he's been basically a minimum guy throughout most of his career. Dallas might not even be able to afford him because he's probably going to get something close to like the mid-level exception or something like that. PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford, two guys that had been on very bad teams, poorly run franchises in Charlotte and Washington, and they were able to come in, fit right in, change the whole tone of the season and the style of play for this group. Gafford fit in so nicely next to Lively as an elite rim-running, rim-protecting big man for 48 minutes a night. And then P.J. Washington was a nice upgrade over a guy like Grant Williams, a guy who's a little bit more consistent offensively, can do a little bit more with the ball. He didn't shoot particularly well through the regular season with them and then struggled really mightily outside of the OKC series. But he won that series for him. He literally won that series for them. If he shoots 36% instead of 47%, like, they don't win that series. And so he was so big for them. And so all these guys just proved that they can be really nice role players on a close to championship team. And then Derek Lively, I've already sung my praises for him, but just so impressed with what he's been able to do as a rookie, a 20-year-old, a guy who averaged 5 points a game in college, who got off to a slow start because he had injury setbacks, a guy who was kind of criticized because they tanked to get that pick and he was the pick, a guy that a lot of people didn't believe in because they just looked at his stats at Duke and said, well, clearly this guy isn't that good. But he's so much better than even what I thought he was going to be, and I was high on him. I thought he was one of the best big men in this past draft, and I thought he had the potential to be an elite rim-running big, which he already is. That's the crazy part. He already is that from day one. And there's so many other wrinkles to his game that I didn't see coming. I knew he was an above-average passer for a guy at his position, but he's even better there than I thought. He's a very nice connective piece. He makes the right reads. He's a good passer out of the short roll. And so if he starts making threes, we saw him make a corner three in this series. If he adds that to part of his game, then it's going to change everything for him offensively, and his ceiling will be drastically different from what probably most people think it's going to be right now. And then even Jason Kidd, who I've been critical of, and I don't think he was great in the finals, but I still think in general this is a stock up season for Jason Kidd, because look, he's made conference finals in two out of the last 3 years. He had some really good decisions throughout this postseason run, was able to win some series where they probably were at a bit of a talent disadvantage at times, and he just put the team in a really good position to execute on a night-to-night basis. So generally a very good Jason Kidd season, and really for everybody across the board. It's really hard to look at this season as anything but a major success, especially given the expectations. You need to remember, people did not expect Dallas to be that good this season. Most people had them at best as a play-in team. I saw some people pick them outside the play-in because they missed the play-in the year before. The West was stacked. There was 11 to 12 teams trying to contend that were trying to be good, and someone was going to have to be the odd man out. But Dallas absolutely rose to the occasion, was significantly better than what expectations had them at. And so this is just a wildly successful season for them. With that said, the question of how close are they is an interesting one, because despite all of the positive things to say about this team for this season, I still think they're not as close as you might think. Like, are they going to get back to the finals next year? I strongly doubt it, because on their run to the finals this year, they avoided Denver altogether. And do I think they're going to be able to make the finals 2 years in a row without having to play Denver? It's unlikely. And so how do they match up against Denver? That's not a matchup we saw. I personally don't think they match up particularly well against Denver. I was high on Dallas. I had them making the conference finals, but I wouldn't have had them beating Denver. And so that's a matchup that they're going to have to think about, one that they're probably going to have to experience in the next couple years. I know they beat OKC this year, but that might have been their only shot to beat them, because they're going to be better. They're going to be back. Chet is going to be much better in his second year, I would think. Jalen Williams got a taste of the postseason. I'm sure he's going to be better and more consistent his next time around. SGA was everything as advertised in the postseason in terms of how he performed. They just made, as I'm recording this, a deal to acquire Alex Caruso for Josh Giddey. So that's a significant upgrade for them in terms of just the fit for this team, what he brings defensively, the connectivity that he shares with Giddey, but the also shooting that Giddey lacks that Caruso does have. So I expect OKC to be significantly better next year. I bet you they're going to add a big man as well. So I'm not even sure that they're going to beat OKC next time around they play them. That's not even to mention some of the other teams like the Clippers, if they decide to bring everybody back, if Kawhi's fully healthy, maybe that's a different series. Minnesota, I know they beat them pretty handily this year, but Anthony Edwards is only going to continue to get better. Plus, they've got options to move Towns if they really want to, or they can just run it back and see if they have a better chance this year against a team like Dallas. But the point is, the West is only going to continue to get better. They didn't have to play Phoenix. They didn't have to play the Lakers. They didn't have to play the Pelicans fully healthy with Zion, or if they trade Brandon Ingram and they're a little revamped. Like, you just don't know how the West is going to look next year. And the West is so goddamn tough. We thought Denver was going to cruise the finals again this year. They didn't even make the conference finals. Like, it's just really hard with how deep the conference is. And one little injury might be the difference between a 3 seed and a 7 seed. And then suddenly you're playing OKC in the first round. You know what I mean? So it's just going to be really, really tough to get back unless they make a move, because it felt like they had the perfect formula this year, but I don't think people are going to be as like unprepared for it as they were this year. And I think that all the other teams are going to elevate. I think Denver is probably going to actually try to make additions this year. I think OKC is going to make some moves. I think just the conference is so good as a whole that it's going to be really tough. And even if they did get back, they might have to play Boston again. And we just saw they are not close to beating Boston. They were not remotely close to beating Boston. So they're far off, in my opinion, in terms of legitimately winning the whole thing. And I think getting back to the finals, even that is going to be really difficult for them. So they're going to need to make a move. And so the question is, what is the move? And they have some flexibility, though not a ton. They've, as of right now, exhausted almost all their picks, but they do have some available to trade once the draft happens. So They owe their 2024 pick to the Knicks from the Porzingis deal. They own their 2025 and 2026 picks. However, currently they can't trade either of those because of the stipend rule, which basically says that you can't trade picks in back-to-back years. Then, because in 2027, they owe that pick to the Hornets for the PJ Washington deal. They have a swap going to OKC in 2028 as part of the deal to get Daniel Gafford in that three-team deal. They traded their 2029 pick to the Nets for Kyrie, and then their 2030 pick is also a swap to the Spurs when they did the sign and trade for Grant Williams. So the only two picks that they don't owe either a swap or the pick itself out are 2025 and 2026, which as right now they cannot trade either because they would be trading two in consecutive years. However, on draft night, once their 2024 pick is conveyed, they then can trade their 2025 pick, and their 2031 pick opens up as well. So they could trade up to two first-round picks in any deal this offseason. They also have four second-round picks available. So it's not nothing that they have to work with. And they actually are $3 million below the first apron right now. They're above the tax, but below the first apron. But $3 million is not a lot of wiggle room. For example, if they re-signed Derrick Jones Jr., that would immediately put them above that tax threshold. Also, because of the tax restrictions they have and because they just had Jones on a one-year deal last year, they can only sign him up to $5 million next year, which on the open market, he might get more than that. So they very well may lose him. And because they're $3 million below the first apron, that means they're only $14 below the second apron. So there's not a ton of wiggle room there. If they sign someone to the mid-level exception, for example, they're immediately in the first apron, and then they're very close to getting into that second apron. But as of now, they do not have the same level of restriction as the second apron teams who can't aggregate salaries, for example, like that. So they could still theoretically put together like a Tim Hardaway plus Josh Green plus two firsts for somebody if they wanted to go get like Jeremy Grant or something like that. It is on the table for them. But if they don't make a move like that, then I don't see where this team is getting the offensive creation outside of that. I mean, the only way internally they could get to where they need to be is if Derek Lively turns into something that we really never thought he could be. Could he be a legitimate all-star player? I don't know if I would have said that coming into this season, but hey, I can't rule it out. I really can't rule it out. Like if he was basically Tyson Chandler that could hit a corner three and also be a good passer, like that's a really, really good player. So I can't totally rule that out. But outside of something like that happened, the answer to their shot creation and offensive struggles that they had in the finals is an external piece. They do not have it on the roster currently, in my opinion. So they either need to hit with some of the draft picks they have, which is going to be difficult because they're not going to have any near the top of the draft because they're sending picks out, as well as the fact that they will be a pretty good team and they also owe swaps out. So it's really going to come down to who can they make a move for. Maybe it's Jeremy Grant. Maybe they decide to take a chance on a guy like Zach LaVine or a DeMar DeRozan, as it appears the Bulls are open to moving some of those guys. I don't know if DeRozan's the best fit from a spacing perspective. LaVine, that contract is really not ideal to take on. But hey, if they got LaVine, I think that's a huge upgrade in terms of just their offensive ceiling, what they would have. They'd need him to buy in defensively, but we'll see. It would still be worth pursuing, in my opinion. That we've seen them take risks in the past by taking on a guy like Kyrie. It's not totally different. So unless they can add somebody of a Jeremy Grant, Zach LaVine type level, then I think this team is maybe peaked out, and this might have been their shot to win the West and try to get that championship, but they fell short, obviously, and I just don't think that this team, as currently constructed, is going to be good enough to do this again, because I just think the West is so difficult, and even if they do make it to the finals again, they clearly were so overmatched against Boston that they would have needed one, maybe two extra pieces to be able to beat them. But maybe Boston doesn't get there. Maybe it's Milwaukee. Maybe New York makes a move and they get in. Maybe Philly makes a move and they get there. So it's not to say it's impossible, but I do think they're going to need some reinforcements externally in order to get there as soon as next year. So, because I don't know if this is even to mention that Kyrie Irving is getting into his mid-30s, and we saw in this postseason that he clearly is not as reliable as you'd like all the time. He's still a really good second option, but they had two series in this postseason where he averaged under 20 points a game and shot sub 40%. Like, that's not the reliability that Luka needs out of a second star, especially when they don't have a third guy that can pick up some of the slack. So that's why I think they need to add a third guy, not only because they just genuinely need three guys that can go create a shot, but because I think they need to take some pressure off Kyrie, because clearly he's not getting any more reliable than he is now, just given his age and the wear and tear on his body. So we'll see what they do, but they should have an opportunity to at least explore some options to improve. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Big congratulations to the Boston Celtics for finally getting over the hump and winning their first NBA title since 2008. But with that said, thank you so much for listening. It was such a fun 2023-24 season. As we close it out and move into the offseason, there's going to be a ton to cover over the next couple weeks still. The draft is next Wednesday and Thursday afternoon, so I will be doing my annual draft preview where I go through the lottery and pick who's going to be an all-star, who's going to be a role player, who's going to be a bust, and as well as call out a couple different non-lottery guys that I particularly like. If you recall, last year I had Brandon Pajemski as my big guy outside the lottery. That panned out pretty well, so I'm going to try to do my best to find the same sort of undervalued guys, as well as trying to project how good these lottery picks will be. So we'll definitely have that out before the draft on Wednesday. But thank you so much to all the listeners who followed my coverage of the entire 24 season, as well as my postseason coverage, finals coverage, all of it. I really appreciate you guys, and I'm looking forward to another season coming up. So with that being said, thank you so much for listening.